Welcome back to TRP.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back to the Rosner podcast. Who is Eugene O'Neill, you might ask, and you could be forgiven for that because on this side of the Atlantic, he seems to have slipped under the radar. Eugene O'Neill wrote over 50 plays and won 4 Pulitzer Prizes. His works include Beyond the Horizon, Anna Christie, Strange Interlude, Morning Becomes Electra, The Iceman Cometh, and Long Day's Journey into Night. In 1936, he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. To this day, O'Neill remains the only dramatist to have won both awards and is regarded by many as America's greatest playwright. This week, I shall endeavour to enlighten you on the life of Eugene O'Neill. Perhaps the reason I'm attracted to such a task is because I knew so little concerning this complex man. Nor do I suspect many Irish people realise his father, James O'Neill, along with his 6 siblings, emigrated from New Ross to seek a better life in America. A regular sailing had been established between New Ross and Quebec, run by William Graves and Sons. The O'Neills lived less than 4 miles from New Ross in the townsland of Tinnerani. And like so many others, James's father Edmund, who was to become grandfather to Eugene O'Neill, the playwright, decided to flee the abject poverty of post-famine Ireland. Edward O'Neill was already 61 years of age. On the 5th of April 1851, he and his wife Mary and their 7 children set sail from New Ross aboard the India, a 3-masted bark, with little knowledge of where they were going or what to expect. Passing the Hook Lighthouse on their port side, they headed out into the broad Atlantic. It was, as all sailings were back then, a hazardous journey. Especially if you consider the O'Neills were allocated just 2 bunks in steerage in a space of 6 foot square and must have had to take turns sleeping in their beds. The voyage was to last 38 days, by which time I am sure they must have grown weary of life and of each other. Finally, on May the 11th, the ship sailed up the St. Lawrence River till they reached the Isle of Gros, where they had to disembark to clear quarantine. Today, a national monument stands on the island, commemorating the Irish who landed here during those desperate years. It is in the form of a majestic Celtic cross, nearly 40 foot high. On its base is a plaque inscribed in Irish to those poor souls who passed this way in search of a better life. The inscription reads as follows: Children of the Gael died in their thousands on this island, having fled the laws of a foreign tyrant and an artificial famine in the years 1947 to 48. God's loyal blessing upon them. Let this monument be a token to their name and honour. From the Gaels of America, God save Ireland. The cross was unveiled in 1909 with a crowd of 2,000 in attendance to commemorate the quarantine station where more than 10,000 Irish men and women were cared for during their mass immigration from Ireland. Sadly, not all who arrived here left the island, and more than 5,000 who were too sick to carry on died and were buried here. The O'Neills arrived on the island none too worse for wear, thanks in no small way to the fact Graves and Sons' ship the India was well run by its captain and crew. Once cleared by immigration, the family continued by steamer to Buffalo in New York State, past the port of Quebec. What must it have been like for young James from the townsland of Tinnerani to set eyes on the bustling city port of Quebec, with ships of every shape and size loading and offloading their precious cargoes, and the quayside busy with the hustle and bustle of trade? It is uncertain as to why they chose Buffalo. Perhaps they had friends or relations there who helped them to get back on their feet. Buffalo had a large Irish community, and perhaps some of those came from New Ross on previous voyages. Though things were better than they had been back home, they found life a struggle. It is believed Edward worked on the docks for 5 years. The newspaper, the Buffalo Courier, described the predominantly Irish 1st and 8th wards as being the spectacle of a most squalid poverty, hardly credible in this land of plenty. Matters were not helped by the fact that James's mother Mary, a native Irish speaker, spoke very little English and conversed while in Ireland through Gaelic, her mother tongue. It was into this harsh world James began life in America. Little is known of those early years and the hardships endured, but it is accepted that they moved to Cincinnati, Ohio when James was 10 years of age. Matters were not helped when Edmund, due to marital problems or despairing at his lot or realizing that he soon would die, decided he could not take any more and decided to return to his beloved Ireland. Shortly after his return, the poor man died on June the 18th, 1862. It is believed he died of poisoning. Whether it was self-inflicted is debatable. An inquiry was held into his death, but proved inconclusive. He was laid to rest in the graveyard of Ballyneal, close to the family home. It is worth noting that Ballyneal derives from the Irish Ballya, or town of the O'Neills. Indeed, the area still has quite a few families of that name. What I found astonishing is the fact that James, abandoned by his father at the age of 10, a young child from County Kilkenny, raised by a mother who spoke very little English and having no formal education, should somehow manage in the space of 12 years to turn things around and become an actor capable of taking on Shakespearean roles. Strangely, it happened almost by accident. James had found a job in the wardrobe department of a small theatre company making costumes for stage, and due to his work spent many hours backstage watching and listening to the performances. During an actor strike, he was able to step in and play a part in the Colleen Bawn. This was to be the first step on his ladder to success. Soon he was playing a variety of successful roles. When playing the part of Romeo in Romeo and Juliet, opposite Adelaide Neilson, the English-born actress, she described him as the greatest Romeo she had ever played with. James was undoubtedly talented and fortunate to have a strikingly handsome countenance. The San Francisco Chronicle of August the 3rd, 1879, described him as a quiet gentleman of medium height, well-proportioned, square shoulders, and stands very erect. He has dark hair, dark eyes, and a rather dark complexion, black moustache, and a fine set of teeth, which he knows how to display to his advantage. As his acting career began to flourish, so too did the interest and attention of his female admirers. He became a most eligible bachelor. It is believed O'Neill first met his wife, Mary Ellen Quinlan, whose mother and father hail from Tipperary, when she attended a performance of A Tale of Two Cities, accompanied by her father, who was an acquaintance of the young actor. She was a young, impressionable girl of 15 and was immediately smitten on meeting James, who was 11 years her senior. At that time, O'Neill considered her a sweet child, nothing more. They were not to meet again for several years. By this time, Ella had lost her father and wished to fill a void in her life. James was taken by how she had matured into a beautiful young woman. Despite protests from her mother, who felt an actor's life was below her daughter's status, 2 years later, on the 14th of July, 1877, they tied the knot in St. Anne's Church between 4th and 3rd Avenue. Only the facade of the church still remains as a folly in front of the NYUS Founders Hall. As faith would have it, James took over the lead role in The Count of Monte Cristo after the leading man, Charles R. Town, died in the wings after the first performance. The play was a huge success, and James bought the rights to the play, set up his own company, and went on tour. James's career went from success to success. He was a big star, a leading man in a New York theatre company, making big bucks and living the high life. Like most stars, he was sucked into the world of celebrity. He was idolized by his female fans, who weren't shy to cast their charms his way. Because of this, James was embroiled in several scandals. One of those scandals broke shortly into his marriage. A young woman by the name of Nettie Walsh, of Irish stock no doubt, sued James O'Neill for divorce and alimony, claiming he had married her 5 years previously when she was an innocent 15-year-old, and that she had borne him a son, now 3 years of age. The case went to court and the papers had a field day, but in the end, James was acquitted. Ironically, the publicity only enhanced James O'Neill's reputation as a star and a Lothario. It was his young wife, Ella, who was to suffer most. Ella was a dedicated wife and accompanied her husband on tour, flitting from city to city, living in one hotel room after the other. Despite the unorthodox lifestyle, Ella was to give birth to their first child, James Jr., in a hotel room. Another baby soon followed and was christened Edmund after his grandfather. Sometimes Ella would leave her young children in her mother's New York home with their nanny for short periods and accompany her husband on tour. While they were away on one of these tours, baby Edmund caught the measles and died. Ella was heartbroken and blamed herself for his death. To ease the pain of heartache, her family doctor prescribed morphine. Sadly, Ella became dependent on it, and the marriage never did recover. Despite their marital problems, on October the 6th, 1888, Eugene was born in a room of the Barrett House Hotel, which was then situated on the northeast corner of 43rd Street and Broadway. The infant weighed in at 11 pounds, and because of his large head, Ella's cousins feared he would be an idiot or a genius. Whether James got home to witness the birth is unknown, but we do know he left the following day to continue his tour. A plaque now commemorates the birthplace. The site is now occupied by 1500 Broadway, which incorporates shops, offices, and the ABC studios. Because of her fragile state and due to the loss of her baby Edmund, Ella began spending more time in their Monte Cristo summer cottage in New London, Connecticut, while James continued his touring across the country. Little Eugene was taken care of by an English nanny, Sarah Sandy, while his mother slipped in and out of awareness due to her prescribed medication. He was baptized at the Holy Innocent Church on West 37th Street, and as a young boy, Sarah used to tell him stories, but not the normal fairy stories. She used to tell him macabre tales that frightened and fascinated him in equal measure. And then she would bring him to museums and look at scary wax figures of murderers and such like. I am sure such events had a profound effect on the young boy's confidence. This insecurity was exacerbated by the fact that, for the first years of his young life, Eugene and his older brother James Jr. would be forced to go on tour with his father and mother. By 1912, James Sr. had been playing the role of Edmond Dantès in The Count of Monte Cristo for well over 30 years. So it was no surprise that when the film version was about to be shot, he was offered the part by Adolf Zucker of the famous Players Film Company. It must be remembered that at this stage, James O'Neill was in his mid-60s and definitely too old for the role. But such was his pulling power, he was hired and directed by Joseph A. Golden and Edwin S. Porter. O'Neill was offered $100,000 to play the part, a huge sum at the time, but he held out for a 10% share of the profits. Sadly for him, the film did poorly at the box office, and he realized only $40,000. His son, Eugene the playwright, was to say of his father in later years that he was a victim of his own success. He simply couldn't afford to walk away from the goose that laid the golden egg. And because of that, his later years were full of regret that The Count of Monte Cristo had destroyed his career as an artist. That role was eventually to earn James O'Neill almost $1 million, though it did take him 30-something years and over 6,000 performances. In 1920, at the age of 72, James was hit by an automobile in New York City and was rushed to the Lawrence Memorial Hospital. And though his injuries were not life-threatening, they discovered intestinal cancer. He retired to his summer home, the Monte Cristo Cottage, where he died on the 11th of August, 1920. He was buried in St. Mary's Cemetery, New London. It was also to be the final resting place for Ella, her infant son Edmund, and her son James Jr. I have spent rather a long time trying to explain the journey of the O'Neill family from County Kilkenny to America and the hardships endured on the way. I shall now concentrate on the enigma that is Eugene O'Neill, the playwright. Though Eugene's childhood was difficult, it was not as harsh or as frightening as his father's. It is true, as a child, he must have felt unloved due to the amount of time he and his brother, James Jr., took second place in their mother's affections. But theirs was not a grueling or a physical hard upbringing. perhaps emotionally, they were deprived of a secure, loving home. That, I believe, was to have repercussions in Eugene's later life. They were born into a relatively wealthy family. They did not suffer the abject poverty, the hunger, or the hardship their father had to endure. Despite all that, James was strict on his children. He wanted them to understand the power and value of money. In 1895, when Eugene was just 7 years old, he was sent to the newly opened St. Aloysius Academy for Boys, a Catholic boarding school in New York City. On reaching his teens, he was sent to the De La Salle Institute on 106 to 108 West 59th Street in Manhattan as a day pupil. Eugene was rather disinterested in academia and was at best an average student. It is interesting to note that as a teenager, Eugene turned his back on the Catholic Church and used it in later life only when necessary as a flag of convenience. Though his father made subtle efforts to steer his son into acting or the dramatic arts by giving him work in his theatre company, Eugene was disinterested, especially when his chief duties entailed inspecting the validity of tickets for the show. He felt this type of play and performance was much too wooden, especially for the youth of a vibrant, buzzing New York City. Having managed to do some poems and articles for the local magazines and papers, his father reluctantly supported him in his attempt at a literary career, and Eugene was sent to Princeton University. He lasted just over a year before he was kicked out. Some say it was his poor attendance. Others, it was his terrible grade. Others claim it was because he threw a beer bottle through the professor's window. That professor happened to be Woodrow Wilson, the future president of the United States. Whatever the truth may be, Eugene was out. In 1909, he met and married Kathleen Jenkins, an attractive young woman of good social standing. They married on the 2nd of October in a secret ceremony at Hoboken Trinity Church. The marriage was soon to fall apart, and Eugene set sail for Honduras on a gold mining expedition. While he was away, a son was born to Kathleen in May 1910. The child was christened Eugene O'Neill Jr. When Eugene Sr. returned to the United States, and making sure that Kathleen was not present, he visited her mother's house to see his infant son. Apparently, upon holding the child in his arms, he wept before handing the child back to its grandmother. The playwright was later to claim that at that stage in his life, he was 21 years old with no job, no future, and that his hands had been tied. His parents had been against the marriage from the start and were not forthcoming with emotional or financial support. They were divorced in 1912, and Eugene was put under no pressure to provide for his child. Kathleen subsequently married George Pitt Smith, who raised O'Neill's son as his own. Soon after the divorce, O'Neill began drinking heavily. He was living at Jimmy the Priest's boarding house in New York. Whilst in a state of depression, Eugene attempted suicide by overdosing on tablets of the barbiturate veronal. He survived, thanks to some of his concerned drinking buddies breaking into his room and resuscitating him. In 1919, some 7 years after that event, he would write a one-act play entitled Exorcism, based on the event. Eugene began to hang around in Greenwich Village with his older brother Jamie. They hung around with the young bohemian, arty, literary and radical types. James at this stage was already in a state of hopelessness that far outweighed his younger brother's despair. He had become a raging alcoholic. Perhaps the defining moment in Eugene's life happened that year. He caught tuberculosis. TB at the time was considered to be the white plague, and most people were terrified of catching it, and those affected were separated from society like lepers. Some saw it as a retaliation from God, a forced atonement, a way to repent their sins. Eugene was terrified and feared he might die. Several members of his clan had succumbed to the disease. His father, James, the actor, feared his wife Ella, in her poor condition, might catch it too, and because of this sent his son to the Gaylord Farm Sanatorium in Wallingsford, Connecticut. It was a working farm with 8 to 10 cottages that could hold up to 12 beds in each building. In the early months, when Eugene was confined to bed, he could glance out his window and watch the cattle roaming the fields in front of his building. A series of tunnels had been built interconnecting the different bungalows so that the staff and patients could maintain contact during the winter months when the heavy snowdrifts came. Fresh air was important in the fight against TB, and patients would sit on the terrace wrapped in blankets, chatting and reading. Set as it was in the heart of the country, it was the quiet and serenity Eugene craved. Here, at Gaylord, Eugene began to read the works of Strindberg, a Swedish playwright, novelist and poet, who often drew directly on his own personal experiences to feed his plots. Those works were to have a profound effect on O'Neill's future plays. Eugene was to spend 6 uplifting months in Gaylord. He used his time wisely, reading voraciously every work he could get his hands upon. He was forced to confront himself for what he really was, a dropout. Without the rose-tinted glasses and the haze of alcohol, he could see clearly. He himself was to claim later in life that Gaylord Sanatorium had been his rebirth. When he returned to New London in June 1913, his friends were shocked, claiming Eugene had entered the sanatorium as a confused wreck of a boy, but what they witnessed on his return was a focused young man. He immersed himself in the works of Nietzsche, Shakespeare, Ibsen, in fact any playwright he could get his hands upon, and set about writing his own plays. His father, having watched his son's previous escapades, felt that this was just a fad, and that his son would throw in the towel and head off to sea again. So it was understandable that initially his father was rather reluctant and stringent with his support, granting his son an allowance of $10 a week while he worked on his writing. To be fair to his father, he did pay for the publication of Eugene's first book, a collection of 5 plays entitled Thirst. On the back of that, Eugene entered George Baker's acclaimed drama workshop at Harvard in September the following year in 1914. Having completed his course in Harvard, he rented a room in Greenwich Village, paid for by his monetary rewards received from working on magazines and newspapers. This afforded him a chance to spend time with his brother Jamie, who appeared to have set up a permanent office in the local, the Columbian Saloon. By this time, Jamie had regressed into a raving alcoholic who talked about setting up his own newspaper. He was befriending prostitutes, bums, hangers-on. Though Eugene loved his brother, he was determined that he would not fall into the same trap and withdrew himself to concentrate on his work. In 1916, he joined a group of young painters and writers, and they launched a theatre in Provincetown, Massachusetts. It was with this tiny theatre group his first one-act play, Bound East for Cardiff, was performed. The group immediately realised the quality of his work and its commercial potential. And later that year, they opened a theatre in Greenwich Village called the Playwrights Theatre. Their first performance included O'Neill's play, Bound East for Cardiff. Although he was just one of the many playwrights who had their work staged, the theatre prospered. Prior to his newfound celebrity, O'Neill had many casual affairs. He had his father's dark, brooding looks that made him stand out amongst fellow Irishmen. Though women pursued him, he rarely pursued them, preferring his freedom to being tied down in a relationship. He did seem to hold a genuine affection for Louise Bryant, an Irish-American feminist and political activist. She was having an affair with an American journalist and a communist activist, John Reed, at the time, and went on to marry him, much to O'Neill's disappointment. On the rebound from this disappointment, O'Neill married Agnes Boulton, a successful writer of commercial fiction who oddly resembled his lost love. They had met in the autumn of 1917 in Greenwich Village and were married the following year. They were to have 2 children, Shane and Una. Between 1916 and 1920, the theatre group had produced all of O'Neill's one-act plays. His play, Beyond the Horizon, was produced on Broadway and opened on the 2nd of February 1920 at the Marusco Theatre. The play won him a Pulitzer Prize. O'Neill was by now gaining national recognition, but the next 3 years were to be the most trying of his life. It was in August 1920 that his father, James the actor, confided on his deathbed that the Count of Monte Cristo had destroyed a talented acting career. He had seen his son win his first Pulitzer Prize and was proud of what he had achieved. The following December, The Emperor Jones opened on Broadway. It featured the first African-American to play a major role in a white American company. In 1922, Eugene's mother died in California from a brain tumor. It was left to her son Jamie to escort the body across the states aboard a train bound for New York. Her death was to further shatter Jamie's tattered life. In May of that year, Anna Christie, a play about a prostitute returning home to her father and subsequently falling in love with a sailor, sweeps the boards and wins Eugene his second Pulitzer Prize. The following year, Eugene's older brother Jamie dies. So severe was his alcohol addiction that he had to be sent to a sanatorium, suffering from an advanced state of delirium tremens. Eugene would base a play he would write 2 decades later, called A Moon for the Misbegotten, on the last days of his brother's tragic life. After the death of 3 members of his family in 3 years, Eugene fell into a deep depression and began to drink heavily again. In 1924, Desire Under the Elm Trees, described by the critics as the first important American tragedy, is hailed as a triumph. In 1928, he receives his 3rd Pulitzer Prize for his play, Strange Interlude. It is a 9-act play in which the life of a woman is portrayed from the death of her fiancé to her subsequent abject marriage. In 1928, O'Neill leaves Agnes Bolton, his wife of 9 years, and their children. In 1929, he marries Carlotta Monterey, a film and stage actress, 41 years old, just like himself, and twice divorced, just like him. She has 1 child, Cynthia Jane Chapman, from her previous marriage. They moved to France, where they lived in a 35-roomed chateau, Le Plessis, in Saint-Antoine-de-Roche, in the Loire Valley. While in France, O'Neill wrote Morning Becomes Electra, one of his most ambitious projects. They returned to the United States after 3 years abroad and set up home in Sea Island, Georgia. Carlotta seemed to bring stability and confidence to O'Neill's life, supporting and encouraging him. In 1931, Becoming Electra hits the stage. It transposes a Greek tragedy into 19th century New England. 2 years later, on the 2nd of October, O'Neill's Our Wilderness opens in the Guild Theatre in Broadway. It is interesting to note that this was his only comedy. Perhaps it had something to do with his much improved state of mind at this period of his life, and perhaps Carlotta was in some way responsible. In 1936, he received the Nobel Prize for Literature, the first and only dramatist to win this honour. In 1939, he writes, The Iceman Cometh, but holds back on releasing his work. Then in 1941, O'Neill finishes arguably his best-known drama, A Long Day's Journey Into Night. Again, O'Neill does not release it to the public. In 1943, O'Neill's 18-year-old estranged daughter, Una, having recently graduated from high school, decides to marry Charlie Chaplin. At 54, Chaplin is 3 times her age and only 6 months younger than her father. Eugene is incandescent with rage and forbids the marriage, but Una ignores him and goes ahead. O'Neill subsequently disowns his daughter. He is never to see her again. Una will go on to have 8 children with Chaplin and remain married to her husband till his death in 1977. In 1945, he delivers the manuscript of his play, A Long Day's Journey Into Night, to Random House in New York, with explicit instructions that the play must not be published until 25 years after his death. Then in 1946, The Iceman Cometh, a tragedy in 4 acts, finally hits the Broadway stage. The drama is set in a New York bar run by Harry Hope and highlights the human need for fantasy and aspiration to counter the trials and tribulations of this mundane life. Highly acclaimed by theatre goers and critics alike, it would be the last play to be released during his lifetime. Having disowned his only daughter, Una, more heartbreak was to follow. In 1948, her brother Shane was arrested and pleaded guilty to possession of heroin. He received a suspended sentence. Humiliated by the press coverage the case received, Eugene disowns his son and never has contact with him again. By now, he has managed to alienate both his children and would never contact either one of them again. He begins to drink more heavily. In 1950, his son, by his short-lived first marriage to his first wife, Kathleen Jenkins, Eugene O'Neill Jr., at the age of 40, takes his own life. His suicide note reads, "Never let it be said of an O'Neill that he failed to finish the bottle." Eugene Sr. was in such a poor state of health, he did not attend his son's funeral. O'Neill's health faltered. He spent his final years believing he had suffered brain damage due to his excessive drinking. Whenever he tried to stop drinking, he would suffer delirium tremens and shake so violently he could not write. This resulted in more depression. As his health failed further, he began to lose control of his arms and legs and would persistently shake. Finally, on November the 27th, 1953, Eugene O'Neill, at the age of 65, dies in room 401 of the Sheraton Hotel. It is now Boston University's Killachant Hall on Bay State Road, Massachusetts. It is rumored, as he was dying, he whispered, I knew it, born in a hotel room and died in a hotel room." At the time of his death, it was believed O'Neill had died from alcoholic poisoning and its related effects. But a study carried out in 2000 showed that he had in fact died from cerebellar cortical atrophy, a rare brain disease unrelated to alcoholism and Parkinson's. O'Neill was laid to rest in Forest Hills Cemetery, Jamaican Plains, Boston. Though O'Neill had directed Random House not to publish his final play till 25 years after his death, Carlotta had it published in 1956, 3 years after his death. Posthumously, it was to win him his fourth Pulitzer Prize and is universally recognized as his finest work. In 1970, his third wife, Carlotta, died and was interred in the same plot. It is a simple headstone, almost a semicircular slab, void of ornation, resting unobtrusively beneath the shade of some small trees. Upon the stone are the words, "Eugene O'Neill, born New York City, October the 16th, 1888, died Boston, Massachusetts, November the 27th, 1953, and Carlotta, his wife, born in San Francisco, the 28th of December, 1888, died Westwood, New Jersey, November the 18th, 1970. Rest in peace. Eugene O'Neill never visited Ireland and never got to see the quays of New Ross, from whence his father had set off as a young boy with his parents and siblings to become one of the best-known American actors of his generation. But Eugene O'Neill was every bit as Irish as Oscar Wilde, James Joyce, or George Bernard Shaw. Though he wasn't born on the island of Ireland, the blood flowing through his veins originated here. O'Neill was proud of his heritage. He once told his son, Eugene Jr., that he found it rather strange that all those people who attempted to write articles about him never really got to the essence of the man, and that the one thing that explained him better than anything else was the fact that he was Irish. I am delighted that in recent years this connection has been recognised, and that through his work the United States and Ireland have decided to honour his dual heritage. The annual Eugene O'Neill Festival has been taking place in Danville, California for over 18 years now. But from now on, we will celebrate simultaneously in New Ross, County Wexford, as well as in America. The cultural ties that bind both countries will be reinforced as the O'Neill Ancestral Trust of New Ross and the Eugene O'Neill Foundation in California unite to pay tribute to this brilliant yet flawed human being. An annual event has been set up, but due to COVID, it might be a little while before we can sit together again and marvel at the force of nature that O'Neill's work exudes. Is it not about time that we Irish broadened our artistic horizons and paid homage to our forgotten son? Long may this bond continue.
Please tune in to our next episode.